Chapter 23. Jolenta. The old orchard and the herb garden beyond it had been so silent, so freighted with oblivion, that they had recalled to me the atrium of time, and Valeria with her exquisite face framed in furs. The green room was pandemonium. Everyone was awake now, and sometimes it seemed that everyone was shouting. Children climbed the trees to free the caged birds, pursued by their mother's brooms and their father's missiles. Tents were being struck even while rehearsals continued, so that I saw a seemingly solid pyramid of striped canvas collapse like a flag thrown down and reveal beyond it the grass-green megathere rearing on his hind legs while a dancer pirouetted on his forehead. Ball danders in our tent were gone, but in a moment, Dr. Talos came rushing up and hurried us away down twisted walks, past balustrades and waterfalls and grottos filled with raw topazes and flowering moss, to a bowl of clipped lawn where the giant labored to erect our stage under the eyes of a dozen white deer. It was to be a much more elaborate stage than the one I had played upon within the wall of Nessus. Servants from the House Absolute, it seemed, had brought timbers and nails, tools and paint and cloth in quantities much greater than we could possibly make use of. Their generosity had waked the doctor's bent toward the grandiose, which never slumbered deeply, and he alternated between assisting Baldanders and me with the heavier constructions and making frantic additions to the manuscript of his play. The giant was our carpenter, and though he moved slowly, he worked so steadily and with such great strength, driving a spike as thick as my forefinger with a blow or two, and cutting a timber would have taken me a watch to saw through with a few strokes of his axe, that he might have been 10 slaves toiling under the whip. Dorcas found the talent for painting that I at least was surprised by. Together, we erected the black plates that drink the sun, not only to gather energy for the night's performance, but to power the projectors now. These contrivances can provide a backdrop of 1,000 leagues as easily as the interior of a hut, but the illusion is complete only in total darkness. It is best, therefore, to strengthen it with painted scenes behind, and Dorcas created those with skill, standing waist-high in mountains as she thrust her brushes through the daylight-faded images. Jolenta and I were of less value. I had no painter's hand, and too little understanding of the necessities of the play, even to assist the doctor in arranging our properties. Jolenta, I think, rebelled physically and psychically against any kind of work, and certainly against this. Those long legs, so slender below the knees, so rounded to bursting above them, were inadequate to bear much weight beyond that of her own body. Her jutting breasts were in constant danger of having their nipples crushed between lumber or smeared with paint. Nor had she any of that spirit that animates the members of a group, forwarding the group's purpose. Dorcas had said that I had been alone the night before, and perhaps she had been more nearly correct than I supposed. But Jolenta was more solitary still. Dorcas and I had each other, Baldanders and the doctor their crooked friendship, and we came together in the performance of the play. Jolenta had only herself, the incessant performance whose sole goal was to garner admiration. She touched my arm, and without speaking rolled enormous emerald eyes to indicate the edge of our natural amphitheater, where a grove of chestnuts lifted white candles among their pale leaves. I saw that none of the others were looking at us and nodded. After Dorcas, Jolenta walking beside me seemed nearly as tall as Thecla, though she took small steps instead of Thecla's swinging strides. She was a head taller than Dorcas, at least. Her coiffure made her seem taller still, and she wore boots with high riding heels.
"I want to see it," she said. It's the only chance I shall ever have.
That was a palpable lie. But as though I believed it, I said, The opportunity is symmetric. Today, and only today, the House Absolute has the opportunity to see you. She nodded. I had enunciated a profound truth.
I need someone. Someone the ones I don't want to talk to will be afraid of. I mean all these showmen and mummers. When you were gone, no one but Dorcas would go with me, and no one is afraid of her. Could you draw that sword and carry it over your shoulder?
I did so.
If I don't smile, make them leave. Understand?
Grass, much longer than that in the natural amphitheater, but softer than fern, grew among the chestnuts. The path was of quartz pebbles shot with gold.
If only the Autarch saw me, he would desire me. Do you think he will come to our play?
To please her, I nodded, but added,
I have heard he has little use for women, however beautiful, save as advisers, spies, and shieldmates.
She stopped and turned, smiling.
That's just it. Don't you see? I can make anyone desire me. And so he, the one Autarch, whose dreams are our reality, whose memories are our history, will desire me too, unmanned or not. You have wanted women other than me, haven't you? Wanted them badly.
I admitted I had.
And so you think you desire me, as you wished for them.
She turned and began to walk again, hobbling a little, as it seemed she always did, but invigorated for the moment by her own argument.
But I make every man stiffen, and every woman itch. Women who have never loved women wish to love me. Did you know that? The same ones come to our performances again and again and send me their food and their flowers, scarfs, shawls, and embroidered kerchiefs with, oh, such sisterly, motherly notes. They're going to protect me. Protect me from my physician, from his giant, from their husbands and sons and neighbors, and the men. Baldanders has to throw them in the river.
I asked if she were lame, and as we emerged from the chestnuts, I looked about for some conveyance for her, but there was nothing.
My thighs are chafed, and it hurts to walk. I have an unguent for them that helps a bit, and a man bought a jennet for me to ride, but I don't know where it's pastured now. I'm really only comfortable when I can keep my legs apart.
I could carry you. She smiled again, displaying perfect teeth.
We'd both enjoy that, wouldn't we? But I'm afraid it wouldn't look dignified. No, I'll walk. I just hope I don't have to walk far. I won't walk far, in fact, no matter what happens. No one seems to be about but the mummers, anyway. Perhaps the important people are sleeping late to prepare for the night's festivities. I'll have to sleep myself, 4 watches at least, before I go on.
I heard the sound of water sliding over stones, and having no better goal to seek, made for it. We passed through a hawthorn hedge whose spotted white blossoms seemed from a distance to present an insurmountable barrier, and saw a river hardly wider than a street, on which swans sailed like sculptures of ice. There was a pavilion there, and beside it 3 boats, each shaped like the wide flower of the nenuphar. Their interiors were lined with the thickest silk brocade, and when I stepped into one, I found that they exuded the odor of spices.
Wonderful, Jolenta said. They won't mind if we take one, will they? Or if they do, I'll be brought before someone important, just as it is in the play. And when he sees me, he'll never let me leave. I'll make Dr. Taylor stay with me, and you, if you want. They'll have some use for you.
I told her I would have to continue my journey north, and lifted her into the boat, putting my arm about a waist quite as slender as Dorcas's. She lay down at once upon the cushions, where the uplifted petals gave her perfect complexion shade. It made me think of Agia, laughing in the sun as we descended the Adamnian steps and boasting of the wide-brimmed hat she would wear next year. Agia had no feature that was not inferior to Jolenta's. She had been hardly taller than Dorcas, with hips over-wide and breasts that would have seemed meager beside Jolenta's overflowing plenitude. Her long brown eyes and high cheekbones were more expressive of shrewdness and determination than passion and surrender. Yet Agia had engendered a healthy rut in me. Her laughter, when it came, was often tinged with spite, but it was real laughter. She had sweated with her heat. Jolenta's desire was no more than the desire to be desired, so that I wished not to comfort her loneliness, as I had wished to comfort Valeria's, nor to find expression for an aching love like the love I had felt for Thecla, nor to protect her as I wished to protect Dorcas, but to shame and punish her, to destroy her self-possession, to fill her eyes with tears and tear her hair as one burns the hair of corpses to torment the ghosts that have fled them. She had boasted that she made tribidists of women. She came near to making an Algophilist of me.
This is my last performance, I know. I feel it. The audience is sure to hold someone. She yawned and stretched. It appeared so certain her straining bodice would be unable to contain her that I averted my eyes. When I looked again, she was sleeping. A slender oar trailed behind the boat. I took it and found that despite the circularity of the hull above the water, there was a keel below. In the center of the river, the current ran strongly enough that I needed only to steer our slow progress along a series of gracefully sweeping meanders. Just as the hooded servant and I had passed unseen through suites and alcoves and arcades when he had escorted me along the hidden ways of the second house, so now the sleeping Jolenta and I passed without noise or effort, almost completely unobserved, through leagues of garden. Couples lay on the soft grass beneath the trees, and in the more refined comfort of summer houses, and seemed to think our craft hardly more than a decoration, sent idly downstream for their delectation. Or if they saw my head above the curved petals, assumed us intent upon our own affairs. Lone philosophers meditated on rustic seats, and parties, not invariably erotic, proceeded undisturbed in clear stories and arboreums. Eventually, I came to resent Jolenta's sleep. I abandoned the oar and knelt beside her on the cushions. There was a purity in her sleeping face, however artificial, that I had never observed when she was awake. I kissed her, and her large eyes, hardly open, seemed almost Agia's long eyes, as her red-gold hair appeared almost brown. I loosened her clothing. She seemed half-drugged, whether by some soporific in the heaped cushions, or merely by the fatigue induced by our walk in the open and the burden of so great a quantity of voluptuous flesh. I freed her breasts, each nearly as large as her own head, and those wide thighs, which seemed to hold a new-hatched chick between them. When we returned, everyone knew where we had been,
though I doubt that Baldanders cared. Dorcas wept in private, vanishing for a time only to emerge with inflamed eyes and a heroine smile. Dr. Talos, I think, was simultaneously enraged and delighted. I received the impression, which I hold to this day, that he had never enjoyed Jolenta, and that it was only to him, of all the men of Earth, that she would have given herself entirely willingly. We spent the watches that remained before nightfall in listening to Dr. Talos chaffer with various officials of the House Absolute, and in rehearsal. Since I have already said something of what it was to act in Dr. Talos's play, I propose to give an approximation of the text here, not as it existed on the fragments of soiled paper we passed from hand to hand that afternoon, which often contained no more than hints for improvisations, but as it might have been recorded by some diligent clerk in the audience, and as it was, in fact, recorded by the demonic witness who dwells behind my eyes. But first, you must visualize our theater. Earth's laboring margin had climbed once more above the red disk. Long-winged bats flit overhead, and a green quarter moon hangs low in the eastern sky. Imagine the slightest of valleys, 1,000 paces or more from lip to lip, set among the gentlest turf-covered rolling hills. There are doors in these hills, some no wider than the entrance to an ordinary private room, some as wide as the doors of a basilica. These doors are open, and a mist-tinged light spills from them. Flagged paths wind down toward the tiny arch of our proscenium. They are dotted with men and women in the fantastic costumes of a mask, costumes drawn largely from remote ages, so that I, with no more than the smattering of history furnished me by Thecla and Master Palaemon, scarcely recognize one of them. Servants move among these maskers carrying trays loaded with cups and tumblers, heaped with delicious-smelling meats and pastries. Black seats of velvet and ebony, as delicate as crickets, face our stage. But many in the audience prefer to stand. And throughout our performance, the spectators come and go without interruption, many remaining to hear no more than 12 lines. Hylas sing in the trees, the nightingales trill, and atop the hills, the walking statues move slowly through many poses. All the parts in the play are taken by Dr. Talos, Baldanders, Dorcas, Jolenta, or me.